session number 10613, rule 11.
Major Charles Burden Taylor, Reel 11. What was the next thing to happen after the return of the remains of Ross Column? Was that the breakout?
That would be about it, yes. I can't remember what period of time elapsed, but from the point of view, anything major was the question of the breakout. And just prior to that, we were given all sorts of maps which indicated that we were going west, in actual fact. On the other hand, I remember seeing, receiving a message pad, which had on it, amongst other things, 150 captured. And I thought that sounded rather good, because it sounded as though we'd captured somewhere along the line 150 prisoners, certainly not in my area. But what it turned out, of course, was that 150 Brigade had, in fact, been overrun for a variety of reasons. And, of course, really, Jerry was in behind us. And this question of the breakout westwards suddenly changed to a breakout southwards and eastwards.
How were you informed of the planning of the operation? Because it was quite a complicated operation to plan. Were you involved in the planning as a second in command?
No. That really came down from the point of view of the company commander coming back and just telling us what we were going to do and when we were going to do it. And what it amounted to was to actually move out of our gap in that particular area. One of my platoons was out on an outpost position, and I was detailed to go and pick it up so that it would join in, really sort of moving past, like coming in from a byroad on the M1, if you like.
And what actually, were you told anything else about the plan?
No, just that basically this idea of going west was not on. The situation, I don't think, was regarded as being lost, or whatever the word would be, but certainly that we were going to go south, and we would certainly be going east, but it wasn't quite clear what was happening in the east.
And what preparations were made for the breakout amongst your company?
I would say nothing spectacular. We just really packed up. We got transport to come in and carry us out. We packed up our own vehicles, and we moved out. It's rather interesting, in a way, but scary, because although we'd seen the odd shelling in our area, it wasn't up to much. But towards where my platoon was, a lot of shell fire was landing. And, of course, in the desert, unlike European damp soil, shall we say, a lot of dust was created, and massive clouds were blowing up, and one had to go into that to find the platoon and bring it out. In the event, it was just a lot of dust as far as I was concerned, noisy, but it's rather surprising that one really didn't get any injury.
So you went out through this shelling, this was the night of the 14th of June.
It wasn't night when we actually pulled out. It was getting literally towards the end of the day. And by the time we got the platoon out and moved a little farther south, then it was dark. But this platoon was about a mile away from the box, which was the main position. And, of course, as we approached it, you could see what was going on. So it was that light.
And what was going on?
Well, this shelling. I've got to repeat that. And as I say, it was a bit scary because there was so much dust. It looked, it was just a lot of shell fire landing. And, of course, being sand, I think the look of it was a little more scary than it actually was. Because I got in there and pulled the balloon out, they all came out with me. And with no casualties at all.
And then what?
And then we moved south, and then it became dark. We'd moved eastwards, and I think we had another day in an intermediate position, and then it was decided that we would move out at night, that night, and again we were going east. I at that time was in fact the tail end Charlie, and
From the Gazala breakout, you actually didn't come into contact with the Germans other than the shell fire?
No, not at that time.
Did you make it back to the positions at Mersa Matruh then, on that ridge?
No, as far as I can remember, it was a fair way short of Mersa Matruh. I'm not quite sure of distances, but I would have thought that we were on fairly high ground. So I think would we be farther west, certainly west of Mersa Matruh.
And which British units were you in touch with at the time?
Oh, I was only in touch within my own battalion.
C Company and the rest of the
battalion? Yeah, that's right.
The battalion was all together then?
Yes, at that time.
So you set out to go further?
Further eastward.
Eastward.
Yeah, that's right. And at this time it was actually going out by night. And rather sad, a full moon. And it almost feels like daylight under those circumstances. But we had been warned that other units were moving at the same time, so we shouldn't get involved with them and certainly shouldn't, shall we say, carelessly open fire on them by mistake, otherwise we might get something back ourselves, apart from causing casualties. And in the event, we went slowly on, and then some people started moving towards me, and I told my driver to slow down, but to also change down and be ready to, you know, make a quick dash in case there weren't ours. And suddenly they opened fire. He put his foot down hard, and we got away from that area in pretty flat desert. But unfortunately, when it changed up, the engine just kept racing, so something had been hit on the vehicle. And so we, as pre-planned, if we were going to be caught out like this, then I said that we had to hop out smartly, each collect a can of water, and follow the rest of the battalion, the direction of the battalion vehicles have gone. They were, actually, officially, they should have stopped, because there was a scheme whereby somebody sitting in the back of each vehicle, if the vehicle behind stopped, then they would stop the driver, and that would go on right up the column, but it didn't seem to work on this occasion. The next thing, well, we just moved. I reckon that the idea was to get fairly well south and then walk east. And during the same night, we heard some noises from, I don't know, perhaps 300 or 400 yards away. And not quite sure who they were, but we closed on them a little bit and finally found that they were gunners. And their truck was completely bogged down, and so we couldn't, in fact, do anything about getting mobile in soft sand, bogged down in soft sand. And so we, I think there were about five of them, a warrant officer and four others, roughly anyway, it might have been six or seven. And so we joined hands and continued going south. The following morning, again, if one can imagine, just a very, very flat area. Parts of the desert were really terribly flat. Slight undulation, then could conceal vehicles and all the rest of it. And then suddenly, over the crest, a few hundred yards away, came some Jerry light tanks and three tonners, that sort of vehicle anyway. And so that was the end of us for that particular period.
How was the surrender negotiated, so to speak?
Well, there's no negotiation at all, really. They were enemy, we were enemy, and as the only officer, I was singled out and popped into a truck in the front
of
the truck.
Did they actually open fire on you?
No, no.
So they gave you the opportunity to surrender?
Oh, yes, no, that was the... that I think that there's no question of negotiation, because I mean they were there and they came to us and we had no option but So, Christ, they're Jerry's. They caught us. And certainly, I don't think it would have been terribly clever to have opened fire with rifles against tanks. Although that has been done, I may say.
How did they treat you in the very... You were saying
no problem, no problem.
They singled you out, you said?
Well, I mean, that's the same in our instructions. If we take prisoners, then you segregate your officers straight away from the men. And they did exactly the same. And I was popped into a truck which carried, I subsequently found out, was probably a Feldwebel, a warrant officer, I would say. And he spoke a little bit of English. And that was that. And we moved at high speed eastward. And then I suddenly saw what looked like a sort of whacking great brown patch across the desert. And it turned out, in actual fact, to be a whole host of prisoners of war. And he stopped his truck, apologized that he would have to hand me over to the Italians. This is not going to be broadcast in Italy, is it? And there I was, and I walked across towards this vast area, and then I suddenly heard the voice yell out, "Good God, they've got Bonzo," which was my school name, and frankly, I still get it from some people. And into the bag I went, and that was it.
Were you interrogated at all by the Germans?
No.
And were you when you first handed over to, when you went over to the crowd as it was? Were you? How did the Italians actually receive you?
I didn't. I can't remember. In fact, particularly at this point in time, so I remember seeing any Italians. There was just a vast area of POW. And I suppose there must have been some Italians somewhere around there. The next thing was, of course, we were later put into trucks and moved westwards.
So there was no, at that stage, there was no sort of induction as a prisoner of war? No officialdom?
No. Well, I think, actually, this, just hours, I would say, or hours unto a day or maybe two, that this vast conglomeration, I mean, they'd taken a lot of prisoners in a very short space of time. And so I reckon there wouldn't have been enough time to do any more than merely guard us, and let alone getting it down to any interrogation.
In these first hours, how did you feel about being a prisoner of war? Was it something you'd ever considered might happen to you? Or?
It's not that, no. At the, I don't think we were ever prepared. Just one of those things that one didn't think about, I think. One was never prepared. I mean, subsequently I found that all sorts of things came out. Two prisoners, hidden in parcels or codes used. Maps on silk, very fine silk, concealed in some way.
But you hadn't been briefed about it?
We'd never, no, certainly not.
How did you feel in yourself, your sort of personal morale? Were you depressed or were you just pleased to be
know.
Alive?
I don't know. I don't really recall having any particular... I mean, we were all jolly tired, I think, because we'd been up a fair amount of time. We'd probably been pretty tensed. I suppose there could have been a feeling of relief. But, of course, as soon as ever you met up with your muckers, you started chattering about what happened to you, where did you come from, where did they catch you, and that sort of thing. So I suppose that, by... If one had been alone, I think one might have felt some very special... feeling of frustration or thwartation or whatever it may be.
So you say you weren't in this sort of temporary camp or just, well, not even a camp,
no,
just a conglomeration. What happened then? You were taken...
We were then taken eastwards and...
In trucks,
yeah. And I think it was... We went through Tobruk motoring. I have an idea we had to stop at Tobruk. But the first place I can really remember was Bache, which is a little bit inland and farther west than Tobruk. And there, for the first time, we were into wooden double or triple decker beds.
An actual camp, then?
Yep, an actual camp, yep. And but again, no interrogation.
What arrangements had been made during the journey about your food and... latrines, well, going to the toilet.
Yes, the... It terribly interesting. I cannot remember. On the way, I can't remember any of those things. On the other hand, I don't feel that I was ever deprived of spending pennies or whatever. At one time, I think it was Parche, we had very basic latrine accommodation, which was really a deep trench and a horizontal, shall we say, fine fir tree, if you would imagine, sort of, what, 3 inches thick, strong enough anyway for us to sit down and hang our backsides over and spend.
What about food?
Food was fairly minimal from memory. I recall very kindly somebody gave me about half a cupful of tea, and which we, in the little group that I was with, we made that last and last and last, because it was really, if you like, part of the English scene as opposed to the scene in which we'd found ourselves. And we even went right through on the basis of we used very little to start with, and in fact it probably wasn't even half a cup, but over the days that we were there we gradually sort of got down to boiling it, sort of whipping it in quickly, having a quick cup of tea, keeping it, doing the same again, and by the time it got to the end of its tenure it was sort of being boiled for about a quarter of an hour. All the question of little mess tins and over home-built fires.
What was the camp like about you?
I would say pretty basic, really. At least we had cover. On the other hand, this was summertime, so one wasn't all that worried about weather. There were these funny latrines. Otherwise, it was just an area. And with not Nissen huts, there were certain, you know, wooden huts, but rather like our wooden huts that we have in the UK.
And what were you actually doing there? You say they hadn't begun any process of documenting you or interrogating
you. No, that I can't remember when we were first documented. I think that was when we got over to Italy. Nothing very much. I think just waiting to see what was going to happen next. There was a possibility. I met up with a chap that I cannot remember his name, but he died very recently, who worked with the Senussi. And there were thoughts of trying to get away from Barchi at that time. But I think that it's very much an embryonic idea. But he'd worked in the desert south, and he was in the same area as we were. And but by the time I think that anything could have happened, we then moved on to Benghazi.
What sort of plan were you looking at?
It was so embryonic. I mean, the only plan that you could think of would be the original idea that I had when I was picked up, and that is go south and go west. Go east, I beg your pardon.
And how to get out of the camp?
Ah, well, that's stage one, and that is always stage... Well, stage one might be preparation from the point of view of saving up food and so on, and then stage two is being able to get out.
And did you have any embryonic plans for that?
No.
So it was just sort of very vague thoughts.
That's right.
And what happened next then? Because you weren't there too long, were you?
No, just days. And then off to Benghazi. And then we were shipped. That was rather unpleasant, I think, because we were put into the hold of our cargo ship. And it very much, they had sort of rather primitive latrines on the decks, but they were in many ways falling over, I suppose, is the best way of putting it, and were not very satisfactory. But in any case, we were pushed down vertical ladders into the hold, literally a hold, and of course our problem was wondering what was going to happen between Benghazi and Italy, and we all just kept fingers crossed and hoped.
You were worried about the ship being sunk?
Well, we all thought that this was a possibility. We didn't really think very much of it. You know, not much as a good idea.
How crowded were you in the hold?
From a crowding point of view, not all that bad. I don't know why that should be, because they could have got more people in. But the main point really was the sheer... It was messy, wet, smelly, and... one would say it's so degrading that it wasn't true. I mean, you didn't want to sit down. And there was certainly nowhere to sit down. I mean, you literally popped in there like cattle.
And how long did it take?
Gracious me. I can't answer that, I'm afraid.
Where were you actually going?
We then went, landed at Bari, and in the southern tip of Italy, and we moved into a camp there. And again, I think that some of the preparation work, it might well have been that the camp was relatively newly built, but again, latrines on this occasion, we had, in fact, the good old standees, you know, the porcelain jobs, so that really, on the other hand, there were all sorts of creepy crawlies around the place. Perhaps because it just hadn't been maintained, or they hadn't expected so many coming over. I don't know.
What kind of creepy crawlies?
I wish you hadn't asked me that. I can't... slugs. What are these things that feed on offal and on excreta and so on?
Beetles?
No, more than beetles. They're just... I can't remember.
No matter.
That's Welsh on that.
So they set you up, and what were the huts like in this? Were you in
huts? Oh, no, these weren't bad, actually. They're brick-built, and, as I recall, fairly new. It was barbed wire all around the place, but that there's nothing wrong with that. That's, you know, you'd expect that. And we were on double-decker bunks, wooden things. But again, no problem there. Again, the weather was good, so one didn't feel cold or anything like that.
Were you satisfied overall with the conditions with which you, under which you were being kept at this stage?
I think, in a way, at that time, one was perhaps happy having traipsed across North Africa into this horrible flaming ship. We probably would have been satisfied with anything, being back on terra firma. But generally speaking, at that time, except for this horrible latrine area, it wasn't bad.
So, what about the way the Italians were treating you? You mentioned earlier that they started to take note of who you were and such like, to separate you as individuals.
Yes. We were all officers now together. Mm-hmm. So that they'd already done the segregation.
But to actually identify you and then... Is this where they first took your name, rank and number, that sort of
thing? I have a feeling it was later, because from there, I don't know about other groups, I don't know whether all the people in that camp went to Chieti, which again was central, about opposite Remini, on the eastern side. And I think we were taken up to our Chieti camp, which turned out to be our next, just over a year, I think I was there. And I think that's when we were first, given a number and that sort of thing, and taken particulars.
So you were only at Bari for a short period?
A very short period, yep.
Well, you were transported to Chieti.
Yep.
By train, was it, or lorry?
By train.
And what was the situation at Chieti?
Well, the situation at Chieti was quite obviously, this was, it was certainly a custom-built camp. Whether it was intended purely and simply for PW or not, it could well have been, shall we say, the beginning of a prison. But basically, there were, I think, about 10 bungalows, but they were brick-built, windows, doors, a normal set of buildings, and completely walled, and a pretty high wall at that. I seem to remember probably about 14 feet high. And inside the camp they had the administration, the Italian administration, and their end was divided from ours by barbed wire. And of course within the camp you had tripwire, so that you really, anything, it kept you from the wall. So any attempt to get over the wall would be scotched. And the warning was that if you went over the wire, then you could be shot at.
The tripwire.
Yeah. And, of course, there were towers at each corner of the camp, and I think possibly one halfway down on each side. But certainly they had the usual towers so that they could look over the camp the whole time.
And you were in this camp for a year. So you said that they gave you your number and things. Did they interrogate you at all at the time?
No.
So it was purely administrative. Did they photograph?
Absolutely.
Did they photograph you or anything such?
Yes. Just with Italians. Certainly were photographed in Germany. And when you mention interrogation, as far as I can remember, the only interrogation I ever had was when they found a tunnel in the room where I slept with two other people. And
that was at Kiev.
And it was that was much later in Germany.
Right, but we'll
that's
we'll
the only interrogation anyway.
Okay, so this procedure, the administrative, this is where you first went through an administrative procedure. How was the camp organised? There was the administrative Italian section and the guards, of course. How about the British? How were you organised within your bungalows and so on?
Well, each bungalow had an OC, an officer commanding. There was the senior British officer, who was the commander overall. I think there was the equivalent, I think, of a quartermaster, although that might have been combined with the job of the people who ran the Red Cross parcel receipts. Red Cross receipts, full stop, not only the parcels, because, of course, we received uniform and underclothing and that sort of thing, next of kin parcels through the Red Cross, and, of course, Red Cross food parcels.
Then did you have any one of these jobs?
No.
Could you just sketch in a bit more detail? So what was the senior British officer's job? What was his role and responsibility within the camp?
I think basically he was the liaison between the captors and ourselves. You have got to have, in any case, I would say, whether civilian or service, you've got to have a chain of command. I would say from the Italians' point of view, they might say, we want somebody who is responsible. And so that he is really our commanding officer. He will keep us in order. Otherwise, I mean, for that reason, we were organised on the basis of these bungalows, as we might call them, so that any orders came through. Each bungalow was divided, about six bays, if you can understand me. Went through the middle of the bungalow, and on either side were the double-decker beds, and then a wall, and then a few more double-decker beds, and a wall, about five bays like that, and washery up at the far end, and the loos at the far end.
And how many men in one of these? Roughly.
Roughly 100, 120. The total in the camp, I think, was 1,000 officers and a couple of hundred other ranks.
So the senior British officer was the man, like colonel.
And that's right.
And the officers were, of the bungalow officers, were rather like company commanders.
That's absolutely it,
Was there any strain about the senior British SBO's position in that he did have to be responsible to the Italians and their orders would come down through? Was that a difficult role, or did you not think about it?
Then I was a meagre captain, and what can I say, that one didn't have those sort of thoughts in a battalion with your own colonel commanding. I mean, he was the colonel, he was the boss, and you got on with your job, and you listened to the instructions and the training, etc. In the case of PW, you had the same thing. You'd support him 100%, and that was certain. And even though you might get, I can't remember any, orders we didn't like, but you certainly supported him in everything he did, because he would be doing it for the benefit of the camp and the British prisoner of war.
At this stage, anyway, with the Italians in charge of Katie, the senior British officer wasn't a controversial post.
No.
What about the officers commanding the huts? Did they have any special responsibilities, the senior officers in each hut? What was their role?
You'd say it was the same, I think, really. We had, if I remember rightly, two. Each bay, or room, if you like, there was a senior board in each, so that you could get a chain of command and you could get information put downwards from the senior British officer through the bungalow commanders, through the bay commanders. And similarly, if you wanted to put anything upwards, you could do it in that way.
What rank?